Good morning. It's about 9:45 in the morning. The heat's already rising. My name is Helgi Johansson, and I'm one of the allotmenteers here at Marina Allotments. We've got a great view down to the sea. We're just in West St Leonard's, and I was going to show you around my allotment.
This is Lekka. I'm Lucy Dearlove.
I've got some like standard Earl Grey, and I've also got a load of mint growing. So there's mint tea, there's also thyme flower tea.
Oh,
I know.
I think maybe that. I've never had that. On this episode, I'm spending some time with the growers and gardeners of Hastings and St Leonard's.
You okay with this one?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I don't think I've earned the title of allotment banker.
Yeah. A little bit of honey?
Absolutely. Town Grown is a Hastings-based food growers network. Back in June, they organised an edible open gardens weekend, where food growing sites all over Hastings and St Leonard's opened their gates to the public. I went along, took my recorder with me, and spent some time getting to know what it's like to be getting your hands dirty in the soil of this part of East Sussex. A former Victorian private garden finding a new lease of life in the community, a very special plot on the site of a former secondary school cricket enclosure, and we're beginning here, on Helgi's plot in Marina Allotments in West St Leonard's.
So we're starting at the back of the allotment, which is under the oak tree. So it's a really shady spot. So you can't really do much with it. You'll see the shed, I painted it black and red. There is a reason for that. So I'm from Iceland and we have colourful houses. My grandmother was from the Faroe Islands and we went to visit the Faroe Islands a couple of years ago and found the house that she grew up in, which was painted exactly like this, red roof and black wooden timber walls. And so I thought, yeah, I'll paint my shed that way. And then the prettiness here is a blueberry bush.
And that's in a pot.
Yeah, so that's in a pot. They like a very acidic soil, so try and make it a little bit more acidic by putting loads of kind of mulch and fern clippings and things like that. Asparagus here beginning to grow, so that'll be probably a couple of years before I can harvest it. It's all trial and error, it's not all success. So that thing there is an almost dead cherry tree. It wasn't very happy in our garden because it's a very sea-exposed garden and it's certainly not happy here. And I've basically given it a final warning. And if it doesn't perform this summer, which it really isn't, then it's going to be chopped down.
No, it's not looking
winter.
Very happy.
No, it's looking terrible. Quite embarrassing. But next to it is a fantastic plum tree that was here already. And last year it produced about 4 plums. But this year it is absolutely dripping. There's a few leeks growing. Tomatoes and aubergines at the back, enjoying the sunshine and the slight shelter there. Some chilies coming up there.
What kind of chilies are they?
Those were actually from one of my allotment mates here, Fred, who just bought some chilies in the shop and planted the seeds. Then Maria, another allotmenteer here, gave me some chickpeas, which are those frondy things at the back there. So we'll see what they do. And then there's some random sunflowers at the back. The onions have been terrible. The badgers got in there, dug a load of stuff, disturbed them. They didn't like it. So this embarrassment of a bed is the onions. But the loganberry at the back is doing very well. And then we get to the Jerusalem fartichokes at the back, which my friend Leanne said, and she gave me some of them. And she said, well, once you've got them, you'll never get rid of them, which is probably true. But I do love them and make soup and stuff like that out of them. Tomatoes in front, bit of a squash, more chilies, gooseberry, raspberry, more tomatoes. And then round here, there's a big apple tree at the front of the allotment. So we've now gone all the way along one of the ends of the allotment and so got to the front bit of it, which is the apple tree. A few other things kind of growing down there, some strawberries. Salsify at the end there was self-seeded. So I'll look forward to tasting the roots this winter.
Yeah,
I never tried it. And then I planted some vines growing up the greenhouse, which I'm not expecting much of this year, but there are
tiny little grapes.
Yeah, there are about 5 bunches of grapes there. Obviously I'm planning on doing small batch kind of dessert wine or something like that.
Obviously.
Very small batch.
Like one glass.
One bottle. Well, I might get a bottle out, actually. Some aubergines down here. Now, next year, I must set a reminder during the whole of May saying, no, it's too early. No, it's too early. Don't plant them out. It's too early. Probably for every week in May, because as you can see, the ones that I planted out really early are just rubbish. Whereas the one down there, I've already harvested one, and that's much
happier. Yeah, it's about three times the size.
Exactly, yeah. Even though I started it later and planted it out later. So
very interesting.
So yeah. Don't plant things out too early. Then I've got a few sweet corn, some courgettes, some squashes, and some beans growing up the side. Supposedly the three sisters. The beans are nitrogen fixing, so there's bacteria in the roots of the beans that fixes nitrogen, so essentially they self-fertilize. And so if you plant them next to other plants, the other plants will benefit from the extra nitrogen that's in the soil. And then the squashes kind of cover the ground and give you weed control, supposedly. They haven't covered the ground yet, but hopefully they will. Again, I planted them too early. And then you've got the sweet corn in the middle. It's a kind of South American way of planting. Potatoes have been a bit disappointing. They've recovered a bit now. I think May was too hot for them. Bit of lavender around the side. So it's on the southwest side. So our prevailing winds, being Hastings, are from basically down the valley. We can see the sea from the end of this valley. The allotment are basically nestled in this valley and going down to the sea, which is absolutely wonderful and looks idyllic. But when the west wind blows and when the storms come, then they come directly up the valley and they hit my beans. So I'm trying to get some lavender and things like that in the borders to try and protect the beans a bit more. I think my most fun things that I did last year is dealing with a glut. So your glut of tomatoes, glut of chilies. I made a Tabasco-style tomato and Tabasco sauce. And so fermented it. It's actually phenomenal. It tastes so good. It's just a secret ingredient that gives a load of umami and wonderfulness to, and a bit of kind of rich heat, but not the sort of blow your head off type Tabasco sauce heat that would actually put me off most of the time. And I also fermented the plums and the apples, and then I distilled it, and I made a Balkan-style rakia or raki out of the plums, which actually, I thought it would taste really rank, but it didn't. It tasted all right. And then I did the same with the apples. Now, I hate cider. I love alcohol in general, but cider is the only form of alcohol where I'd rather choose to stay sober than to drink it. But I distilled that as well, and I made Calvados. And the Calvados was really tasty. The only thing you need to be careful of is, because there's pectin in both plums and apples, when you distill it, that turns to methanol, and the methanol comes up first, so you need to discard the first part of the distillate so that you don't go blind and get methanol poisoning. So had the house, well, initially the upper flat, and then we bought the whole house and turned it into one house. Had that for the last 20 years, but also have a flat in London, and my work is in London. Although my husband's almost retired, and he spends a lot more of his time down here because it's phenomenal. I'm very much a morning person, always have been, ever since I was little. Used to really affect my parents when I'd crawl into bed with them and demand to be read to at 4:30 in the morning. And of course, in the summer in Iceland, there is no darkness. So the sun is basically shining from about 2 a.m. till midnight. So I got the allotment here a couple of years ago, or nearly 2 years ago, September, which is actually a really good time to take on an allotment. So if anyone's thinking about it, September is your sweet spot. The growing season is over, and especially if the allotment is in a bit of disarray, then you've got the winter to do something with it, to change it. And so mine was just full of couch grass. There was nothing discernible here. And so it took a lot of blitzing. It's been hard work, but it's been really quite amazing. I may have got a little bit obsessed by it. Maybe. The weather is both a challenge and an advantage because it very rarely freezes here. Because even when it's cold elsewhere, you've got the ridge that protects us from the north wind, and you've got the sea, which is always warmer and so protects us from the frosts. We had a couple of frosts this winter, but they were very mild. Although one of them was in May, which was super annoying. But then you've got the storms and the salt wind, which a lot of the trees and legumes and things really don't like. So trying to get some sort of shelter in is really helpful. My other challenge has been, I think because this allotment spot was neglected for a couple of years, was the soil. The soil was really quite poor. It's clay. You're under the oak tree, so the oak is very thirsty and drinks out a lot of the water in the soil, so it dries out quite quickly. And my main winter project for the last two winters has been to improve the soil, dig in loads of organic material. Initially, I went for a no-dig approach, which, in retrospect, I think works perfectly well if you've got soil that's already good, whereas if you've got bad soil, then it takes a very long time for it to improve. And so I've kind of decided to go for something somewhere halfway between, rather than an absolute no dig or an absolute dig. For those beds that have good soil in them, I'll make them no dig, and those beds that are poor, I'll dig the hell out of them until they get better. So I've had a garden for a long time. I'm trying to think when I got my first garden.
Did you garden in Iceland?
Not really, although I grew up for the first 9 years of my life in the east of Iceland in a one-horse town called Egilsstaðir, which is actually the biggest thing in the east, but at the time it was a village of 700 people. And my mum went to work and I was at a childminder's called Sofia, and she had a big vegetable park garden down at the bottom of her garden, growing potatoes, kale and the sort of things that grow in Iceland. But then I got my own garden, I think probably in 94, when we bought our first house while I was at med school. And then there was a bit of a change in my life, blah, 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 blah. And so I stopped having a garden for a while, but then got another one in probably about 99, 2000. And I've had one ever since, really. It's just become part of what I do. And I just get a massive kick out of growing things and eating the things that I grow. I probably spend a lot more money on it than even if I went to the most expensive organic greengrocer and bought the vegetables from there. I would probably still save money compared to what I spend on this. But actually, it's highly entertaining and very satisfying.
Now, we're moving up the winding hilly streets of St Leonard's, away from the sea, to a lush garden in the middle of a square. St Matthew's Gardens used to be for the exclusive use of the Victorian residents of this square, complete with its own tennis lawn. But now things are a little different.
Yeah, of course, I'm Will Taylor, so I grew up in the area of St Matthew's Gardens. My parents still live here, along with my sister, and when we had the chance to move back into the area, I was all over it because, yeah, I loved the gardens growing up as a kid. I always felt that this is almost like my spiritual place.
Did you come here as a kid?
Yeah, we came here as kids back in 88. So we just had a massive storm. Like, it was the hurricane.
The storm of 87.
Yeah, the storm of 87.
I've heard about it.
Massive hurricane that Michael Fish got completely wrong and said, don't worry about it. But they were trees down everywhere. Around the perimeter, you'll see that we've still got a lot of Austrian pines. Mm. Originally, the gardens were surrounded by them. So you get a sense for the scale of the devastation that hit in 87. But for a kid, it was just a magical playground.
So I'm Jenny, I'm Will's wife, and I'm the lead gardener here, so I manage all the gardening.
We moved back in 2013, and during that period of time, there'd been a lot of volunteer efforts to tidy up the gardens and make it back into a more usable space. It was laid down by the Victorians for the enjoyment of exclusively the people of St Matthew's Gardens. Yeah, there were actually a number of these pocket parks, private gated parks, across Hastings and St Leonard's. So we've got all of these interesting little spaces, and I think that it's a crime not to share them out with the community. During lockdown, it was a godsend for a lot of people.
A lot of people use this space because they had to have, I mean, we forget, don't we, but that you had to have an open space to go to within walking distance. And so people were desperate to find somewhere they could go. You know, of all the negatives of the COVID period, I think people started to appreciate their local green spaces a lot more as a result of sort of stopping and looking around and finding these little spaces. But yeah, in terms of the history, so it was very formal, I guess. We actually don't have any photographs of what it was like in Victorian times.
We've scoured. We have had a couple of super keen metal detectorists that came over time, and we've got some great finds which shows the use
since the
Victorian period, and actually some older stuff from when it was farmland.
We found a spindle whirl. And it's post-medieval. We had it. We sent it off to Portable Antiquities, and they analysed it and sent it back to us. So this was all farmland at one stage. And then, sort of, so it's always been a place where kids have played. We found loads of kids' toys, old lead toys.
Yeah, we found like a mini pistol.
Yeah.
And
little trucks.
Yeah, little trucks and old cowboys.
Cowboys. Yeah.
Yeah, metal cowboys. So you know that dates it to about the 50s when a kid lost it.
And then during the war, this was used as a training ground for the Home Guard and a Canadian regiment that was stationed locally. We've got sort of vague bits and pieces of history to that, but we've confirmed that because we found fired rifle bullets.
I can't remember what the caliber is, but they were definitely Home Guard caliber because they were from World War One. So they were using the World War One rifles in the Home Guard.
All the old guns were given to the Home Guard, and the new stuff went to the troops. So. So and then after that, it's just been used as a sort of a family recreation space.
Yeah. It was handed over from what's the trust?
So Eversfield Trust. They own a lot of the land around here. So it's in the deeds of all the houses.
And it was gifted in perpetuity to the people of St Matthew's Gardens. But in the 1960s, it was asked that the management of the gardens transfers to a committee. That is where, you know, the purpose of the space really changed.
We just built on the foundations that were already here. We've had a lot of very proactive people who have had a real passion for the gardens, and we've just added to that. And our previous chair was very keen on sort of bringing in the community, and again we've taken that forward. We have lots of local school parties and that sort of thing that come and use the gardens.
Most of the houses have been converted in this area. There are still some which are 100% intact, but you know there's people with flats very very much so in the sort of nearby area who all need green space. So we just took the view over time that the catchment area, although we are clear as to who is within that, we are quite flexible with it and quite nice with it.
And we try to keep our memberships affordable for people too.
Yeah, that's the big
trick
of it.
And we have the local scouts and the guides and the local school that come and use the space.
Sometimes the schools come over to draw the flowers, which is lovely. Sometimes they come over for a bee talk about life cycles. And then the kids will wander off and try and find little insects in the undergrowth just so they can catalogue it. I love seeing the space being used for that.
And I was the one who started the food growing. There was a few things here that could be eaten, but there wasn't any real community food growing here. That's my contribution, I suppose, is to introduce community food growing. And so now we have community orchard. We planted a walnut tree, which we won't see the fruit of, but hopefully...
But it was great because we did it with the kids.
The kids planted the tree.
And the kids were so excited with the idea that, you know, when they're old and grey like I am, they will probably see walnuts on it.
So what's the time frame on that?
Oh, it's going to be about 30 to 40 years.
Well, sometimes sooner. It depends how well the walnut tree does. I mean, sometimes within 15 years you can get walnuts, but I mean
I reckon it's a long game.
It's 50 years for it to become a mature tree, so so that one's, but then it's planning for the
future.
But
that's the wonderful thing about doing this all. It's not about what we're getting from it at the moment. We're just building and building and building and giving an opportunity. And some of the things that we've done have been not for our benefit, it's been for the benefit of the wildlife of the area, so dead hedging, wildlife paths, creating a specific area where we let those pesky weeds, or what people would term as weeds, grow, because they are absolutely critical for insect life and for other small rodents and what have
all
you.
The things that build up the biodiversity of an area.
And we've seen that increase drastically.
Yeah, we've now got lesser stag beetles living.
Oh, I'm so excited.
I know.
Jenny got hit by one and it
flew
brilliant.
Into me. I was like, so excited. It was
That's a big deal, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Yeah, we'd like the big ones. We'd like the proper greater stag beetles with the lovely horns, but we'll take a lesser stag beetle.
Yeah.
That's fine. Lesser in name only.
Exactly, they're still beautiful. Exactly.
So the community food growing, again, we try to involve the members, we try to involve the kids as much as possible. So I grow a lot of veg that's kind of... it never makes it to the dinner table, basically. So peas are a massive hit.
You can't get a kid to eat a pea at dinner time, but if they pick it off a bush, that's it. They want it.
Raspberries is another winner.
Oh, yeah, the raspberries got picked clean the other week when they all discovered them.
So the fruit trees that we've got orange gauges, plums, pears, apples. They're all quite young trees, but they are producing. Yeah. And then gooseberries and blueberries, and somebody gave me a goji berry plant, so it's surviving. Yet to produce any fruit, but we had about two on it last year.
What about your elderflower, where you made the elderflower champagne?
Yeah. We've got elderflower, so I make elderflower champagne every year. Where we've been trying to increase the biodiversity and the natural sort of wild stuff, there's tons of edibles that... forageable edibles that pop up. So we have wood sorrel, loads of wood sorrel. We actually have a log that produced chicken of the woods last year. I'm going to see whether it...
You weren't feeling daring enough.
I wasn't daring enough to eat it. I was pretty confident in the identification.
Something ate it, though.
But it's kind of nice to know. It's kind of nice to know, yeah. It gives us a great deal of peace, I think. Mm. Peace and sanctuary. And other members have said the same thing. You know, it's a place that they can come where they feel... you know, it's just they can take time away from their busy lives, even though we're right in the centre of town.
It has changed so much in the years which I've been part of it. And I only see myself as a passing steward of the space. But it's important that we keep it looked after and maintained. Yeah. Yeah. And if we can improve it and make it more relevant to people over time, then let's do that. And the usage of the gardens has increased dramatically since I was a kid. It used to be mostly just people jumping over the fence. Nowadays, it seems to be because we've got a large membership and we've got people that genuinely respect and
care about the space.
Yeah, thank you. It's just a wonderful place to be.
Out of town to the east of Hastings, down a tiny track just wide enough for one car at a time, is a plot called Small Meadow Farm. All sorts happens here, from permaculture education to off-grid camping. But I'm here for a particular reason. Apples, along with the odd pear and quince.
So when I arrived, it was covered. I've got four major infestations here. Thistles... the big marsh thistle, they're giant. They look like warriors of, you know, like they're just really menacing. Ragwort, which is obviously quite an invasive thing that you have concerns about with like cattle and things like that, is poisonous. Sycamore, which are those tree seedlings, and they're very prolific, and brambles. So what I inherited was these four weeds, basically. So my name's Anna, aka Permaculture Anna. I was a community gardener in North London and just really got bitten by permaculture. And with that kind of sustainability lifestyles and, you know, systems thinking and all the rest of it, it's also experimentational that I was like, just want to put all this into practice. Mm-hmm. And then it's very much get back to the land, get back to our roots as humans. It's not really anti-capitalist, but it kind of ends up being a bit anti-capitalist. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like looking for a new way. Permaculture is about that. I would say it's a kind of experimentation into a new sustainable lifestyle. You know, how do we not rape and pillage nature, but do everything maybe like we used to traditionally. Anyway, I was obsessed with it, and I sort of still am, but because I was a gardener and I was doing loads of forest gardens, and I was like, oh my God, this was the easier way to grow food. I was like a food growing activist. So I'd go around community centres and hostels and schools and teach people how to grow food from seed. But, you know, that is that's a harsh journey compared to setting up a forest garden or a forager's garden, which is what my book is called. we're here. I've always been in love with Hastings. I always was going to downsize from London. And when I downsized from North London, I bought this field, which at the time was less than a studio flat. And I was just there like pinching myself going, I don't believe this. But, you know, I was so driven and it was a dream and I just kept working towards my dream and it took 15 years. So now I've ended up on the outskirts of Hastings in Fairlight. It's a 10-minute drive and I'm here every day just sort of having this great relationship with a piece of land. So it's 4.5 acres. 1 acre is in a wooded area, but out on the field, about a third of that was brambles, and the brambles were 3 meters tall. So I was like, gulp, how the hell do I get rid of these brambles? And I had a meadow expert, because like I was within these networks of like Weald, you know, the Lund Fund and High Weald. At the time, it was called the Meadows Initiative. So this guy came for free and he was like, what you want to do is get a tractor, claw off the 3 meters of brambles, burn them, get this thing called a harrower, which is like a sort of chain on the end of a tractor that kind of rakes it up a little bit, and then stick some sheep on it. So yeah, I was from central Camden. I was like, okay, sheep. Never really had a pet in my life, apart from a cat I had to give away. So I just Googled and found on Preloved some Hebridean sheep. And that's how I got started with the animals. And I'm still the worst shepherd ever. But I have learned some basics along the way. And they were only supposed to be here for 3 years. But this is, I think, 8 years after getting them. But the good thing about Hebrideans for me is they're not very friendly and they won't let you touch them. And considering I can't catch them, that's a good working relationship that we have. So, yeah, it's a low maintenance off-grid way to manage pasture. This is an acid grassland environment, and it's a rare environment. I was already very passionate about wildflowers and the fact that 97% of our wildflower meadows have gone. And so before I came here, there were three things I knew I wanted to do. One, guard the wildflowers. Two, plant an orchard. And three, experiment with loads of forest gardens. And also, water is the hardest thing. So I thought when I first got here that I wouldn't be able to harvest enough. Fact is, I've got 8 IBC tanks. So they're those meter cubed big things. They probably overflow about 8 or 10 times over winter. So there's a lot of water that I'm not catching. Like, I want to catch it at the top. So this is a big slope. So, you know, everyone was like, oh God, it's so slopey. And I'm thinking permaculture brain, that's a great thing because I've got gravity and I can move water, you know, and I've got the trees in shade. And I kind of design the land along contours. So, you know, permaculture is also like where you put things in relation to other things. It's like you're trying to get to this holistic vision of integration of everything that you're doing so that everything's in the right place and you don't have to work so hard, you know.
Tell me about the orchard. Oh, you mentioned that. Yeah. That's was one of the things you wanted to do when you got the land, and it's one of the things you have done.
Yeah. So there were so many rabbits. So first, I knew from a previous project that I probably should just rabbit-proof it. And in the early days, it really makes me laugh because we'd enclose the orchard, but there might have been rabbits there. So I actually got this, what are those animals? Ferrets. So this woman came with a white ferret. And she would just come because she wanted to feed her animal. So she like turned up and put them down all the holes in the enclosed bit. Oh, but she didn't get any.
Okay.
And then, so I enclosed it. And then I chose some amazing traditional varieties. And I planted it in 2 phases. So because at the time I had no water and we were literally bringing it in vans. from an industrial estate, and it was hard graft. And then a few years later, I got the Lund Fund for the Sussex Varieties Orchard. I've got this amazing book called Apples and Orchards in Sussex by Brian Short, and one of the co-writers, Peter May, I was friends with on another project. He'd like grafted into a garden in a forest that I'd done. He's mostly related to the permaculture crew in Brighton, and he really helped with Stanmer Park and developing that and grafting all the Sussex varieties there. He is the guy who has all of them, but at the time he only had 22. So I bought 22 of the varieties off him as trees, beautiful trees. And then for the other ones, I planted just the rootstock in the place where the tree was going to be. And he came, and I'd done grafting where you take like a stick and you put it onto a rootstock. But his grafting was like he just took one leaf bud out of the stick that was in the ground. You know, it just looks like a tiny little eye in the bark of the plant. And he took the tiny little eye of the tree that we were grafting and did the surgical procedure with great precision and put a bandage around it with the sharpest knife in the world. The whole tree has grown out of one little shoot. It's amazing.
And you said that the collection isn't actually complete. There are four missing varieties that people aren't able to find. Is that right?
Well, I think they know where they are, but I think just when I was developing the orchard, I just couldn't find them, you know. So there's space for them. So, yeah, I mean, it's been such a journey because, one, just how popular apples were, you know, they were just like something that people would talk about, like celebrities. Can you imagine now? People don't talk about apples for more than about 5 minutes. There's so many subtleties, you know, whether it's like a nutty flavour or like a white flesh, or it's got like, you know, when you get like streaks on a cox, they're like streaky things, or you get ones with flecks in it, or, you know, they'll be describing them via the lenticels of the apple skin. But for me as a cook, I'm like, can I make applesauce? Some of them will just fluff up in like 10 minutes. You're like, whoa. Or, you know, is this going to be like a French pear, you know, apple or pear tart? So you need something that won't go mushy. And then for me, the amazing thing has been like the jewel apples. So some are cookers and some are eaters, but there's this huge amount that are jewel. And it's just like getting to know their individual personalities. Yeah. I'm just on the beginning of a journey. And we'll do an apple day. So part of the Lund Fund was me doing outreach and teaching people about these traditional varieties. And now that I can, I'm like thrilled. We've got apples from Bexhill, Brighton, Hastings, Eastbourne, near Cambersands, then over towards like West Sussex. There's just this whole world out there that we've forgotten about.
If you get the train on the Charing Cross line into St Leonard's, just before you get to the town, a big expanse opens up out of the east side of the train. It's what's quite obviously a school field, a big modern building and then a big green expanse with sports pitch markings on it. And if you know what you're looking for, in the far corner of the site, you'll spot a densely growing section behind some fencing.
Yeah, so I suppose before all the magic began, it was kind of a bit of a waste corner of the school grounds. So we used to have some cricket nets here. Oh, there's that train.
Oh yeah.
Will that be audible?
Yeah, but I quite like that.
Okay, cool. So we've got a small enclosed area that used to be used for cricket training, and that forms our allotment. And then there's kind of a bank above it, most of which is not ideal soil for growing in. Hi, I'm Elliot Riley. This is the food forest from Future Growth at Mulberry Academy St Leonard's, which is a reasonably large state secondary school on the southeast coast of England in Hastings. So I have been growing with the kids here. We are now approaching the end of our second full year of Future Growth. We planted a few trees the year preceding that, and there have been ongoing kind of food-related projects on this site for about a decade, I think. So there were a couple of raised beds when we arrived. Project Rewild have done some work here. They've done some work in-house. But as future growth, we've been running full-time for just coming up on 2 academic years now. The site is divided up into kind of 2 main areas. We have a regenerative allotment where food is grown in soil that is pretty much made out of waste materials. So we've got coffee from Stooge Coffee Shop. We have lots of mushroom inoculated sawdust, which comes from Basil's fungi farm. He gives us all of his waste. And we also turn school food scraps into compost. So we grow lots of vegetables there. We then also have a food forest on the bank above the allotment, where we are growing a regenerative food forest in soil also enriched by waste materials. So we've got a member of staff called Jake, who has been doing amazing work in the last few months by frequently visiting some of the local supermarkets and bringing the food that they no longer want to stock but is still absolutely legal for consumption, bringing it into the school to distribute amongst kids who'll benefit from it. And then anything that does then not become able for consumption becomes our compost. So our food is being grown in the waste food that is provided by the supermarkets, absorbed by the kids as far as possible, and then anything extra goes back into soil production here. And most sessions, the kids will come to me and we'll spend maybe 10-15 minutes having a chat, having a catch-up in the classroom, and working out how everyone's mood is that day. Are they feeling stressed? Are they feeling depressed? Are they feeling anxious, irritable, gassy? Whatever's going on for them. We'll then come down to the garden and I will introduce the students to a new skill, whether that is sowing seeds, whether that's weeding, whether that's using chop and drop techniques in the food forest, whether that's propagation, whether that's sign painting. And then the idea is that each time students learn a new skill, that's kind of added to their arsenal. They can come and say, no, I don't want to do weeding today. I want to keep building the keyhole bed that I did with you last week because it made me feel focused and the hammering was a great way to get out some of my anger. Or they might say, actually, I'm feeling quite low. I'd like to just sit and do some weeding. So the provision is first and foremost a well-being provision where the kids are given a smorgasbord of skills that they can use to improve their mood, but the output of those skills is food. We're growing vegetables, and we're also building a thriving ecosystem which will produce fruit for the next 80 years, hopefully. Sometimes they will just approach us through the fence and be like, I want to come in, and we start a conversation through that. Otherwise, there is what is called a boost referral process, which is just one of the well-being mechanisms that exists within the school. If a kid is struggling with their grades, if they're struggling with their mental health, if they are having a hard time one way or the other, they will be referred through the boost process. Future growth is one of a number of outcomes of that process. So students are referred to me because they've got poor mental health. Generally, that's it. If they're not self-referring, it's because they're struggling with their mental health. And the students who have expressed an interest or potentially would benefit from a positive male role model or clearly need the opportunity to be able to learn to re-embody themselves but find PE an overwhelming experience, they will come to me. And because it's instead of their PE, that means that by default students are with me 3 times a fortnight. So they'll have kind of 3 sessions of 100 minutes, which begins out as lasting for a term, but some of my students have been with me for the best part of 2 years now. So for the most part, there's kind of a natural selection process, but it means we've got a really nice contingent of kids, some of whom have kind of been with me for quite a long time now. And they go by the term FGOG, which stands for Future Growth Original Gardener. When I was at school, I was initially very keen to join the army, but had quite kind of basically as a person who was quite cynical, had what I could only describe as a thunderbolt god moment where this like I saw this flash of light and a voice in my head being like, yo, don't kill, man, life is enough. And I was kind of like shaken to my core, and like whether that was a psychotic break, whether that was God, whether that was me, I'm gonna trust this. This feels pretty loud, this feels significant, so I'm gonna trust it. I then went on to do my degree in history and philosophy at university, which I adored, really enjoyed. And through that process was kind of set up with a nice cushy Shoreditch postgrad job in an ed tech company. But then the pandemic struck in my third year, and suddenly all of these topics that I'd been learning about, you know, alienation from land and shifts in power, all became very apparent that these weren't historical topics. We're still living through them. And I saw global supply chains fracture overnight. My entire world was suddenly shaken. It's like, this stuff is not resilient. We don't have this skill set there. So I realized that I wanted to be doing something more meaningful, but didn't know how to begin. And I suppose the other important bit of context with this is that I was fortunate enough to get an enormously discounted place to a very good private boarding school. I also got a massively discounted place to a very good private university. So not only was my thinking, I don't know what to do, but it's, I've received on paper one of the best educations in England, and I don't know how to make a grown-up decision for myself. What is wrong with this picture? So I suppose with those two questions in mind, I kind of went upstream. It was during the pandemic and I had the time. So it's like, okay, how have we got to a stage where the world is so fragile and where education does not give us the skills to develop resilience? And through that process, I learned about a school in the Dominican Republic called the Human Hive. And these guys were a trauma-informed, learner-led school who at that time were teaching a module on permaculture. And I was like, well, I can either stay in my dad's flat in Bexhill during a pandemic, or I can go and volunteer in the Caribbean, learning about all the things that seem most important in the world. In hard terms, they were building a food forest. You know, I wasn't aware of permaculture. I wasn't really aware of these systems. So I just saw them transform this kind of like dry, hydrophobic, broken bit of land at the back of their school pretty much overnight into this thriving, abundant system that was absorbing water and absorbing waste and kicking out food and biodiversity. So I was like, this is sick. Like, this is really exciting. I want to learn how to do this. So what I'm doing here is in many ways what they were doing without the mangoes. We have planted a pawpaw, but yeah, like, it very much is kind of a locally adapted model of what they were up to. So we have four golden rules in Future Growth: no violence or unkindness, no touching tools without permission, no climbing trees without permission, and if I tell you to do something, you do it. But you can also always communicate back with me. And on that basis, kids know that if ever they are removed from the provision, which doesn't happen often, it's not because they've broken a rule, but rather because they have demonstrated behaviour that means I can't keep my group safe, which is quite different from some of the rules that you have around the school, which then also means that everybody participating feels safer, and students know what they can. They can scream and make noise and be angry and run around and vent, and that's permitted. And then once they've done that, they can re-engage. We're placing things like borage, we're planting lots of root crops, which have the explicit purpose of breaking up the soil. We're then applying lots of mulches to improve its water retention, as well as kind of then planting the traditional structure of a food forest. We're not letting things rewild without human interaction, but we're planting things like Jerusalem artichokes, because I know people can often be quite nervous about them, because they'll say they'll spread like a weed, which they absolutely will. Once you've planted them, they're very hard to get rid of. But I'm quite excited about them because firstly, they are the UK's highest calorie per square foot crop that we can possibly grow. If you have them where you do not want them, they're then an incredibly effective form of biomass because you can chop them, drop them, which will eventually over time starve the tuber. Where we've got this little cluster of them there.
Yeah.
In their first year, they grew up to ankle height. They're now about waist height. A really, really happy Jerusalem artichoke will get up, you know, it'll be taller than us. But by breaking up the soil as they are, they're doing those with roots rather than mechanical force, which means they're improving the biological activity within the soil rather than damaging it.
Okay.
But then should they start to become a nuisance there, I'll just chop those to the ground and mulch the olive tree or the grape tree with them. And then when they resprout, I just do it again. But as a low maintenance way of getting calories everywhere and anywhere, they are so easy. They're also very tasty. Will make you fart when you first try them. And also, interestingly, the Jerusalem element is a misnomer. It comes from girasole, which is Italian for sunflower, which is what they look like when they grow to maturity. So for our lower canopy, in here we have 6 apples, 7 apples. We've got 2 plums. We've got a broadleaf hawthorn, which has incredibly fat, juicy berries. We've got some wild cherries and some wild pears. And an olive tree. Then underneath that, we're establishing kind of a tall shrub layer. So we have elders and hazel, both of which are really useful actually, because they allow you to control the level of light. Because you can chop them back quite easily and they'll resprout, that not only provides us with wood, but it also means that as we're dealing with climate change, we have the opportunity to produce more shade in the food forest, which we can remove if needed. Below that, we then have an edible shrub layer. So we've got honeyberries, raspberries, currants, a gumi berry, which is just about holding on for life, but I'm very excited if it works. Eliagnus multiflora. Nitrogen fixers are a big part of working with food forest. We tend to rely on broad beans because they're just incredibly easy to plant and replicate. But having nitrogen fixing shrubs is kind of something that is always useful to have. But obviously I want them to be fun for the kids as well. And the Eliagnus multiflora is the only one I found that has sweet berries. Mm. So it's a sweet perennial nitrogen fixer.
Bit more exciting than a broad bean.
It's more fun than a broad bean. Yeah, exactly. So then alongside the canopy, the tall shrub layer, the lower shrub layer, we've got lots of mints, we've got lots of mallows, we've got lots of kind of things that we're treating as edible weeds. We've got lots of comfrey, which is a really useful dynamic accumulator. We actively encourage dandelions to grow in here. We've got lots of kind of tall prairie-like plants. So we've kind of intentionally been sowing brassicas, cardoons, verbenas. Horseradish is great because it spreads really quickly and we're experimenting with making a cough syrup with it. And then this sunny bank at the back has cooked everything else I've planted in it. So we've been experimenting with it as a Mediterranean bank. And as you can see, the grapes are stupidly happy. This also has the added advantage that they will then be hanging out the fence so kids can come out at break time and just snack on the grapes that grow through the fence. The grass is obviously a real balance because on the one hand, it can smother younger, smaller plants. On the other hand, it means that it's very rare for us to have bare soil, and it's also a fantastic mulch. We're constantly chopping and dropping it, and we explain to the kids the way in which we should have ruminant herbivores going through the landscape, and we're trying to get them to behave like it. But I don't ask them to chew and poo the grass. I just say, please, just... That's a step too far. But rather than being a particular plant that has done well, what has surprised me so much is the success of the lasagna beds and just how vigorous the growth has been, because they are... They're sawdust, coffee, and a top dressing of compost. Dug ground versus not dug ground, or the no-dig method, is a very big popular conversation. And it's really important. Protecting the integrity of the soil microbes is vital. The problem with the no-dig method is that it does also require a huge amount of compost, which, unless you're already producing compost, is very expensive. So it makes it inaccessible. The lasagna method focuses on using freely available and abundant resources to make a compost pile in situ. So you build the container of your bed, and it can be anything from our, you know, I hate to say it, Amazon metal raised beds, or even just a pile of kind of sticks that form an edge. And then you layer the green and brown materials that would go into making a compost pile. So your greens are the things that are very high in nitrogen. That might be grass clippings or, confusingly, coffee. And then browns, so shredded paper, shredded cardboard, wood chips, sawdust. And if you can layer those together and then top dress them with compost, you're effectively building next year's soil with a small amount of accessible compost right now. So I was expecting our first plants to kind of serve as semi-sacrificial plants, you know, they're going to get the soil life in there, they're going to establish the root network, they're going to cover the soil, and they're going to add more organic matter, but they are pumping. So this is my own, this is my first personal project. And quite excitingly, I've now been given the go-ahead by the school to get a rolling pattern where I'm not just working here, but I'm designing a second school site and implementing it on a third each year. From a food security point of view, we have to have it everywhere. And I do not need to be the person making it happen, but we need food growing in every single community space available. That's kind of without... I'm going to put myself on the line here. That's non-negotiable. If we want to survive as a species, we need regenerative food growing everywhere. That's how the societies that have done well have lived. And it is the lack of that that is causing us to have the dangers which are kind of existential that we do today. So if I can kind of play any part in just making it so that there is more food growing in more places and also more waste being turned back into that food, those are closed loop systems in places that are meant to provide for the future.
If you're interested in supporting Elliot's work, you can sign up as a Patreon supporter of the Offset Food Forest. The school pay for his time, but nothing else, so any regular financial support he can find is essential to continue the work he does with students in the garden there. You can find him on Instagram at offset_food_forests, and I will put the link to that and also the link to the Patreon in the show notes of this episode. Likewise, you can find out more about all of the growing sites featured on this episode in the show notes on the LECA website, and how you can visit, get involved with them, support them, whether that's joining the allotment waiting list, find out about wild camping or permaculture courses at Small Meadow Farm, or joining St Matthew's Gardens as a member if you're in the local catchment area. As a fun little thing for this episode, I've also produced a single page zine about each story. You can read little bits of those on Instagram. Or if you go on the website for this episode, which will be linked in the show notes, you can download the file for free and print them yourself if you'd like to do that. It was just a fun way to tell the story of some of the things that I learned about these different places. Thank you so much to Helgi, Jenny and Will, Anna and Elliot for being part of this episode. And thank you to Towngrown for coordinating the edible open gardens. I had such an amazing time. I saw a couple of other places that I didn't end up featuring in this. And it's just so cool to see these sites within what is kind of relatively quite urban, a town, and then the kind of more rural surroundings of it. How people are growing, what they're doing, what challenges they're facing, how they're kind of practicing resilience in the face of those. I find it very inspiring, and I really recommend getting involved if you're local and attending next year. You can find LECA on Instagram at LECA Podcast and on Substack too. This is an independent show which is very generously supported by listeners. If you enjoy what you hear and you're in a position to do so, you can sign up as a paid subscriber to support LECA on Substack, Patreon and Apple Podcasts. The links are in the show notes. Thank you so much to any paid subscribers listening here for your continued support. And another thing you can do that will really support LECA is tell people about it and subscribe in the app that you usually listen in and leave a rating and or a review. All of those things are hugely helpful, so please do that if you enjoy listening. Thanks for listening. I'll be back very soon.